Welcome to The Right Side with Andrea and Kim. I'm Andrew Ruth, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Kimberly Ross. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It has been so long since we've done this.
I know. I don't think we quite planned on taking quite so much time off, but it just kind of worked out that way.
It did, yes.
So I haven't looked at how many subscribers we've kept and lost, but if you are listening to this because you have stayed a subscriber, we love you, don't we, Kim?
We do. We love you so much.
And if this is the first time you've ever listened, thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening. We'll be soon moving to ARC Digital. A podcast will be a part of their group of podcasts. So if you're listening to us on there, thank you for joining us. But Kim, we want to tell everybody what they can do if they are listening to us.
Of course, you should go to iTunes and find The Right Side with Andrea and Kim. You can subscribe there. You should also leave a review. And we love 5-star reviews because that is definitely what we're worth, for sure. Right, Andrea?
Yes, definitely. Yes. So we have had Christmas. We've had New Year's. Mm-hmm. We've had, what else happened in January?
Well, there's a few things that happened in January. But no, it's been the holidays and a lot of like personal things and busyness.
Yeah,
I think
most of January for me was being very, very on top of a cross-country move. I was yes. ready and packed and had all my stuff organized and yeah, ready to go. I was doing that and getting stuff together for that. So now I am in Arlington, Virginia, instead of the Pacific Northwest, which is crazy.
And you are a member of the DC elite. Yes. So people, when you hear the snobbery get worse from Andrea, it's because she's part of the elite crowd now. I don't know how long she'll talk to me. I'm not part of that crowd.
Well, you know, Kim, it is funny because the other, not personal. Well, I mean, I guess this was personal and professional, is that within the first week, you said that people would be, what did you say? Sending cars for me to be on TV
yes.
or something like that.
People will send cars for you and ask you to be in studio to talk about politics.
And
guess what? That happened.
Not 8 days later, but that was because of something that you and I both did, which if you are listening to this, you probably already know that Kim and I made a rather grandiose and much controversial, I guess, to some people, exit from Red State and Town Hall and Salem Media as an entity. So do you want to just kind of like touch on that real quick on how we came to that decision?
Sure.
And what happened?
Well, definitely. I had been there 4 years, and Andrea, you'd been there like 2.5 years or something.
It would have been maybe 3 this year. Yeah.
Almost 3. Yeah. And I know both of us had had our own frustrations with Red State for a while, especially since the quote purge that happened in April of last year when Caleb Howe was let go, Ben Howe, Jay Caruso, Susan Wright, Paterico, a bunch of good writers who happened to be
Neal Stephens, who was one of the
common. Yeah, Neal Stephens. Mm-hmm. They happened to share one thing in common, and that was they had no problem being critical of Trump. And they were some of the most vocal Trump critics at Red State. And they were all let go. There was no one who was kind to Trump who was let go. And as we've said before, Salem said it was a financial decision, which doesn't make sense to me or plenty of other people, and it seemed very much an ideological decision. And since then, we've definitely seen a kind of a decline in how Red State has been run, and just the idea that the front page started becoming more pro-Trump than ever, and we had our own issues with that, and we decided to leave. And so we wrote, and Sarah Quinlan, also a writer, she at Red State, she left as well. And Andrea and I decided to write a piece about why we're leaving and just the kind of conservative media in the past few years, how it's either been you have to completely criticize Trump all the time or you have to be a huge cheerleader for him. And I think both of us, which is great, we're interested in consistency and we have no problem praising him when due, of course, but there's a lot to criticize him on. So we wrote this piece, published it at The Bulwark, and it kind of blew up from there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you saw some backlash from it. I did too. But one of the big things, and this is why Andrea is part of the DC elite now, Brian Stelter at CNN wanted us to be on reliable sources. So we went on reliable sources a week ago and spoke to him pretty briefly. It was kind of a short segment, but we spoke to him a little bit about what we thought of the red state direction that had, you know, that had been taken, and just our feelings about conservative media. So it was interesting and a strange experience, but I'm glad for that opportunity.
Yeah. You know, one of the main things that I wanted to say on that segment, and I totally agree with it, John Podhoretz of Commentary, who was also one of the founders of the Weekly Standard, he had said when he, you know, when they kind of were doing their autopsy of the Weekly Standard on the Commentary podcast, made the comment about how, you know, conservative media is supposed to call out the other side's bad ideas and keep our own side honest and not and keep them from becoming corrupt when they're in the power structure. And I feel like that is exactly where Red State was going. They had, you know, weren't keeping their own side honest, finding every reason to, I mean, at least, you know, there are, like, again, there are still people who are critical of Trump left there. But at the same time, the preponderance of the people who frequently posted there was, non-Trump critical and honestly just straight up clickbait, which I, yeah, you know, as an editor was frequently, you know, disturbed by. So, not to get, you know, too dog on, you know, our former colleagues, but yeah, I am glad that we, you know, people kind of went after it. Why did you go to the Bulwark? Look, you know, mm-hmm. When it comes to that kind of thing, it's kind of who, you know, Jim Swift has been a good friend of, you know, I mean, he and my fiance kind of, you know, they go out and get, you know, lunch every once in a while now that we're here in DC, and, you know, it's just kind of like who, you know, and who you're friends with and who you can confide in. And that just happened to be the person, you know?
And I think we also discussed too, and we weren't really asked this on CNN, but before CNN, we had all these, you know, questions that we had to discuss in like the pre-interview and everything. Why did we choose the Bulwark? And we've said this before, that we discussed perhaps other places to publish at, Daily Beast, The Atlantic, wherever. CNN, I don't have any context there because I'm not part of the elite. But I think it was really powerful to have our voice like lifted up at another conservative site, mm-hmm. and our frustrations shared by another conservative site. And I really respect the kind of independent thinking over at the Bulwark, because they definitely aren't on the Trump is amazing and he's the Messiah bandwagon. And I think it's important to let our voice come from another conservative place, because it would be easy to just send it to a like middle of the road or left leaning site, because I mean, they're not a fan of him at all. But it's important for other conservatives to say, hey, we see what happened there and we agree with you and we'll let you share, you know, our story, your story, I should say. But as you were talking about Red State in general, we had plenty of frustrations at Red State, but I think a lot of people who know about Salem in general realize that it wasn't just a Red State problem. There were so many other entities under the Salem media thing, umbrella, that were leaning to Trump in ways that didn't allow for criticism. And we mentioned some of those instances in our mm-hmm. piece. It wasn't just, you know, all these other Salem sites are great and they have a very measured view of the presidency. No, it was definitely a leaning, you know, of the whole Salem media as a whole, leaning toward the you must be less critical of Trump. And we saw that when we were talking about Hugh Hewitt and Michael Medved and other people. So it's kind of an overall thing. It's not just say, well, we're saying Red State is doing this. It's a lot of other places as well. So that was frustrating.
Right. And one of the things that I brought up as an editor or a former editor at Red State was just what happened after the purge, with there being no, you know, hierarchy structure, really any control whatsoever editorially by anyone at the site. So it was, and it was constantly, anytime there was any, you know, effort to exude editorial control, you know, there was at least one instance where Town Hall did get involved and, you know, and say, you know, more than one person needs to agree on that, which there was always one more than one person agreeing to take something down if it, you know, didn't meet editorial standards. But once that kind of went out the window, I kind of stopped writing there. And again, that is what the chilling effect that we were talking about, that, you know, people who were critical of Trump basically stopped wanting to have their name up there. And that kind of got, you know, some questions about it too. Like, I was on BATF, which is a YouTube show that I go on every once in a while. And, you know, Bill McMorris from the Free Beacon was like, well, you know, it's, you know, your name is going to be, you know, on the same site as things that you disagree with. And it's like, okay, yes, that is true. But when things are flat out embarrassing and not, you know, there was an, you know, a post, because there's no editing or editorial, you know, stance or anything like that anymore. There's, I think, still an article up there with a misspelled word in the title. You know, instead of judicial, it's judaical, you know. So, I mean, and they're not talking about Jews. So, you know, it's those kinds of things that made it, you know, more and more difficult. And, you know, people, you know, said, why did you have to go out like this? Why did you have to, you know, put out this article, and why couldn't you just leave quietly? I think when things are going in a certain arc and that things are corrupted, and I really do think that there is a corrupt element into the way that, or not corrupt, I guess smelly way. I don't know how to exactly like put that into words, like distasteful, bent towards how, you know, the entity that is Town Hall in Salem is wanting to run Red State like it has Human Events and Bearing Arms and run them as content mills. I don't find that as, I think people need to know that it is not, people still DM the Red State Twitter account to, you know, saying, Eric Erickson, will you please respond to that? They don't understand that Eric's not there anymore. That's how tuned out people are to Red State. So when it comes down to it, do I think that it was a big deal that you and I left Red State and left the way we did? No, I don't think they did, because I still don't think that a lot of Americans know what Red State even is without other than, you know, they think that Eric Erickson still works there. So I don't think it's that big of a deal. I didn't spend a lot of time looking at Twitter or Facebook or any kind of social media other than what people put in front of me. And I didn't spend a lot of time on that because I don't think in the scheme of things that people really cared whether or not I was at Red State or not. But I think that it was important that people know what's going on there so that they do know that there is, you know, a lack of holding our own side, keeping our own side honest on the right in a lot of areas, and we're not meant to be cheerleaders for the president or for Republicans, and the moment we start doing that is the moment that we stop, you know, kind of standing for what conservatism is supposed to be about, which is, you know, getting the culture to move right, not just the party.
And I heard, I mean, I think you as well, and even Sarah, who left, her, you know, heard people ask, why would we leave in such a public way, and what were we getting out of it, and you sold your soul, and blah blah blah, all that stuff. Well, I was for a long time really proud to be part of Red State. The only gathering I was able to go to was in 2015 when Eric Erickson, who was the editor at the time, disinvited Trump for what he said about Megyn Kelly at the debate. And I was proud to be part of a group as, you know, not as big as, you know, some other sites and everything, but proud to be part of like a grassroots kind of a blog that pro-life. Stood against, yes, pro-life especially, stood against this behavior from a candidate. And we didn't say, you know, it's fine because he's Republican. We said, you know, no, that's questionable and we can't endorse that kind of thing. And so I was proud to be a part of it for a long time. And that's why I think I really wanted to make clear that we believe that conservative media can get better. We believe that Republicans as a party can improve, and we should want that. We shouldn't want them to stay where they are. And it's okay to point out the flaws on our own side. And I think we definitely don't need to shy away from that. Don't we want to improve and not just be the other option? We want to be the best option. So that's why I really wanted to say something and say it vocally, because I was not ashamed to be a part of a Red State for a really long time. And toward the end, I definitely was. So I think it can improve. Not sure if that will take, how long that will take, or if it will have to be after Trump is out of office. But I mean, we believe in conservative media and commentary, and we want it to get better. That's why we said what we said.
Yeah. And Brian Stelter asked a question that, you know, at the time he said, is there an audience out there for, you know, Trump critical or just, you know, honest conservative, you know, media writing about, like I said, keeping our own side honest, but calling out the other side's bad ideas. I think that if there's not an audience for that, I don't think that should matter to conservatives. I think you keep writing what you're writing and, you know, there's a reason why Jeff Bezos and the owner of Clarity Media, they're billionaires. Why? Because they lose money. That's their money losing propositions. When you start trying to make, like Salem Media does, and you know, for Red State and things like that, when you're trying to make them money makers, you're going in the wrong direction. And I think that one of the things that it says more about media than it says about whether or not there's an audience for it, that they're just constantly trying to go after where the dollars are. Now, like we said on this podcast over and over and over again, and like I said to Brian on Reliable Sources, I don't know. I don't think we can know. We are in a whole new frontier. We're only a decade into Facebook and we don't know. And we didn't know that these problems existed until 2016. That's a very short amount of time to do a biopsy on what's going on with American media. So I mean, I don't have answers, and I think it's stupid to walk around acting like you do have answers when all the best that we can do is hypothesize and say like, well, maybe this will work. You know, National Review has had to go to a completely different, scale on how they publish their stuff. You know, they've got NR Plus and things like that, and they're great. You know, they're still producing great content, and they produced all kinds of different, both Trump friendly and Trump critical, and you know, all kinds of great content on there. And you and I are now over. I did not have this in the works at the time that we did this. I actually just offered to kind of like, you know, help out because ARC Digital is it's a small but growing but quickly become, you know, it's being what more and more well known for being, you know, just a very fair place where both Democrats and Republicans and progressives and conservatives can come together and put their, you know, minds and thoughts together. And a lot of times it is just very thoughtful, you know, articles. It's not, oh, here, we've got the answer for this. You know, it's a lot of, they have, you know, philosophy and society arcs and politics arcs that go over all, everything that we're dealing with. And the answer is not to always have the answer. Sometimes the answer is just to sit back and think about things and make points, and you don't have to have a set answer. And I think that we're really in a time of media right now where we don't know where, like how the media is at. I know one thing for sure, how media has been acting in the past, you know, decades has not worked. It's not working. And we know that because it's falling apart, and they're now this institution, the fourth estate that we're all supposed to, you know, trust to hold our, you know, elected officials accountable. We're not seeing that. And people are very, you know, the media has, I think, a worse approval rating than Congress, and that's pretty darn low. So
yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah. So anyways, I mean, that's kind of like, I guess, our little, you know, recap of that whole, you know, thing. Anyways, what I was saying before is that I then was, you know, offered, hey, you want to, you know, do some associate editor type role. So I'm getting really involved in their social media aspect and getting things more streamlined for becoming a bigger publication. And it's been really exciting. And it's the stuff that I love doing, you know, the digital
side. She's really good at that background stuff in the organization. It's stuff that I'm horrible at. Andrea's really good at that.
Yeah. So we're all having a lot of fun and you're the over there too and contributing elsewhere. And that's the thing. I think that, you know, when one door closes, you know, it's like The Sound of Music, you know, when God closes a door, he always opens a window. So, you know, there was that window. Sarah is also contributing at ARC and other places. And so, you know, I think that immediately says that is there a place for, Trump critical conservative media? I think that the fact that we were picked up so quickly says yes. So
yes, I think so too.
All right. So Anything else you want to say? Or you want to move on to the state of the state that I'm now a resident of, which, you know, go ahead.
No, I think we're, as you would say, we put a bow on that red state quitting and all that stuff and that whole issue. So, yes, we want conservative media to improve and we think it can be done. How long? We don't know. But now that Andrea is a member of the elitist East Coast, she has moved to the state that has been in a state of disruption for what, the last 2 weeks, two and a half weeks or something?
Yeah, pretty much.
You guys, Virginia is the worst place ever. Everyone in high government up there has either put blackface on and gone to a party in the 80s or is accused of sexual assault. I think, I don't know how many people have been accused of something now, but it's a lot. I mean, it's only actually been three or something, but still it seems like everything is falling apart there. So Andrea is a new resident of this state. Why don't you talk about the stories and where it's at right now?
Well, you know, it's funny because it's like I came from Washington State where we have, you know, Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell. Maria Cantwell, it kind of flies low, like, you know, you never really hear from her. Patty Murray, because she's been around for forever, she is just always, she's in the upper echelons of the Senate Democrats and stuff like that and has her face out there all the time. And so I'm kind of used to that, you know, kind of crazy, you know, politics of the Pacific Northwest. But moving here, I did not expect, you know, blackface from 35 years ago and, you know, sexual assault. But yeah, so Governor Northam, which this is the amazing part, Kim, and I know that you are amazed by this, and so many conservatives are. This whole thing started by the fact that I believe Caleb Hull posted, which, you know, think of him what you want to, but he posted this audio, actually video, of Governor Northam on a radio show talking about this new bill that was proposed Virginia legislature, and he basically was discussing infanticide, and and conservatives were just like, my God. But it was barely a blip on mainstream media. And then within a day or two, this photo comes out of Governor Northam there was one person in black, in like really dark blackface. It's a black and white photo that was taken when he was at medical school, which, who knew, you had, you know, everybody's kind of confused. Like, there's, you have college yearbooks, but standing next to a guy in a Klan uniform. Now, just regardless of who is, you know, wearing what in that photo, it's pretty problematic. And as much as we, you know, as conservatives kind of like always kind of dog on things, anything being quote unquote problematic, this was kind of something that, you know, when it's Democrats and they're so into, you know, oh, you can't wear blackface, and which is, you know, that's a perfectly, it's unacceptable. You know, there's no reason to do it, especially nowadays, but this was 35 years ago. So, you know, the conversation becomes then, should we have a little grace? People, Democratic caucuses are calling in the state, are calling for him to resign. Just loads and everybody on media is, you know, in the mainstream media saying, he must resign, he must resign. Well, then they start going to the next person in line, that which is the Lieutenant Governor Fairfax. And he's being credibly, what everyone says is a credible accusation with very many fine contemporaneous details from the woman who says that he sexually assaulted her or forced her to perform, you know, sexual acts on him during the 2004 Democratic National Conference, I believe so.
And then
the next person in line is the Attorney General, and guess what, he comes out and admits, yeah, I wore blackface too. So that then goes to, so now they're in kind of a little, the Democrats are kind of in a little bit of crisis because the next person in line is a Republican. So because he's the Speaker of the House in Virginia. So which is a Republican. So you kind of get this weird, and now with Fairfax, they're introducing articles of impeachment against Fairfax. And so now it seems like Northam, even though he has the Democratic Black Caucus in the state, he's got all these other Democratic groups, and his staff assigned him homework to go and watch Roots, you know, over the weekend, things like that, that he's going to try and like weather it, you know. And of course you see, I saw this morning watching State of the Union, there was one woman that said, you know, tried to blame this on Trump, and thankfully she was excoriated. Thankfully she was basically excoriated for that. Like, don't, like, they were like, don't even, this was 35 years ago. You cannot blame this on Trump. But yeah,
Trump was doing other things 35 years ago, yes. But it was not making Northam put that picture in his yearbook or go to that
party. Yeah. His dad was keeping blacks out of it, renting apartments in his building, like, but you know, yeah. So, not to make light of that either, because that's something that's very important to remember about our president as well. But you know, the thing that, that I, you know, people say, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, Northam shouldn't have to resign. He shouldn't have to resign. And there is that case to be made. And I understand why people make that case. I'm inclined to say, yeah, you shouldn't, you know, something, you know, for not hurting anybody physically, you know, 35 years ago and doing something that, you know, Adam Carolla always talks about. He posted his photo that when in 1982 at a Halloween party, he went as Mr. T because he loved Mr. T, and Governor Northam says that he, you know, the reason why he was dressed in blackface was because he was impersonating Michael Jackson. So, you know, these are people that they're, you know, admiring, but still it's something that's still seen as, you know, problematic. And at the same time, Governor Northam, during the, I think the primary season or during the general election, went after Ed Gillespie, calling, you know, basically saying that this, you know, for all of his issues, Ed Gillespie's, I don't think, is a racist, and he's a perfectly decent human being, but why should Northam be afforded the same grace that he didn't afford Ed Gillespie? I think that that's a really, you know, National Review's David French called it cheap grace to give Northam the grace that he didn't afford to somebody else. So, and that's where my problem is. It's like, why should you get this grace that you did not give to someone else? Other than, you know, we're all magnanimous, but when you do something like that, does it make the person learn a lesson, or does it make, and will Democrats be able to, you know, lose kind of the quote unquote moral high ground? I don't know why I said quote unquote. It's just the moral high ground. I think their perceived moral high ground on these issues. If Northam just gets to fly under the radar and it just, the story kind of goes away, because the news cycle has moved on to Donald Trump talking, you know, alluding to the Trail of Tears when Elizabeth Warren announced officially her, the end of her exploratory committee and deciding that she's actually going to jump in the race. So
I would say my biggest issue with Virginia and all that's happened in the past 2 weeks is, of course, the fact that Governor Northam and obviously the representative Kathy Tran, I think is how you say your name, mm-hmm. or something, how they have essentially endorsed infanticide, and how that was kind of glossed over as, oh, Republicans and conservatives are looking at what he said and they're like, they're bloating it out of proportion. It's not actually what he said. He didn't really say that. And how dare you guys attack abortion because of a woman's right and everything? Well, I'm sorry, if Democrats talk about how a child is not actually a child until the moment of birth, then what are they doing now? They're saying that after the moment of birth, when the child is out of a woman, then if you don't want to give life-saving measures to the child after a botched abortion, then it doesn't matter. You can just let the child die. And that should be a problem no matter which side of the aisle you're on, if you're in the middle, if you're pro-choice, pro-life, whatever. So that is my biggest issue with Governor Northam, the kind of casual reference to infanticide, and then the Democrats casually like shrugging it off as something that the conservatives have created. Now, as regards blackface, I don't think that's ever a good idea. David French on Twitter last week or the week before or something said that he grew up in the like 80s. He understood like he was around the same age, I guess, at the same time that Governor Northam was. And he said, you know, I never, ever, ever thought blackface was appropriate. And that is a good point, because plenty of people have said to me and said to others, you know, just in general, well, that was the 80s. That was kind of like an okay thing to do. No, it isn't an okay thing to do. And if you thought it was an okay thing to do, then there was some sort of issue that you have that's been kind of ingrained in you for a long time. It's never okay. Do I think someone who was in blackface at a party in college in the 80s, do I think that should keep them from running? Do I think that should keep them from continuing in office? I generally don't think, as long as they're honest about the circumstance, I don't think that should keep someone from staying in office. I really don't. I think we do need to extend grace to people. There's issues that other people on the right have had in their past, and if they're honest about it and they don't continue in that sort of behavior, which I think is a big problem if they do, if they don't continue in that sort of behavior, then sure, you can stay in office. You need to be apologetic, and you need to try to make amends and talk about how you've learned from it and are moving on. But should people be removed from office, that's a different story. And I don't think we need to start attacking everyone for bad decisions they made back then. And there was an article in Washington Examiner. It was by Daniel Payne. And he said, "I'm a Virginia conservative and I don't think Northam should resign." And it's essentially saying what I said, that if this was a mistake he made in the 80s and it's not this behavior that he's done for years and years and years since then, and if he's not lying about the incident, you know, saying that, oh, that was, well, I think right now we don't know if he was even in the picture at all or something, but if he lied about the incident, then that would obviously raise a lot of red flags about his abilities to be governor and be, you know, executive of a state. But if he had this incident back then, has moved and learned from it, moved on, and is not lying about it, and then sure, he can stay in office. Do I think that that's the worst thing he's talked about in the past 2 weeks? No. I think racism is disgusting, and it goes against every you know, moral code that we have. Do I think infanticide is worse? Yeah. And I'm not saying that racism, we should water down racism, but I think casually talking about the taking of a life or leaving a life to be discarded is worse. And then the Justin Fairfax thing, that's kind of, it's been interesting to see how Republicans deal with that in light of everything that happened in September with Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. I think there are two different circumstances. There, you know, the people who said that the people who were, named by Christine Blasey Ford as being at the party or knowing about the incident, they have no idea, you know, what occurred. There were certain specific, you know, details she could not give. Now, in this instance, Fairfax said he was there. This woman said she was there. One said it was forced. One said it was consensual. So I think that's probably a bigger issue. And should he be removed from office? Yeah, I would say he probably should, because that seems like something that is substantiated with a bunch of evidence. And says, I think, a lot about his character. So the third guy, I don't know if we'll ever get to him.
at least he came forward quickly and said, yeah, I was in blackface, which is and what,
then,
yeah.
And then this week, one of the funny headlines from, I mean, it's not funny because it's not a good situation, of course, but a Reuters headline, it says, Virginia Republican comes out and says he was never in blackface when he was in college. And I was like, the fact that you have to come out and state unequivocally, I was not in blackface decades ago. That's where we're at right now. So it's crazy, and it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. But I think the fact that Democrats are more bothered by the blackface and everything that is involved with that than anything Northam said about infanticide really says where their focus is. Now, we should all be concerned about racism, but can we talk about priorities as far as treating human life the way it should be treated? They're off base. And they are all the time. And the fact that they're the social justice warriors of the political spectrum, and they're trying to fix this huge problem that is all about race relations, it just says a lot about where they're at right now.
Yeah, and I think the last time they polled it, only 18% of Democrats were on board with third trimester abortion. So I mean that whole topic is something that's out of step, and it kind of plays to Planned Parenthood's role in giving money to Democratic office seekers is that they are looking, you know, the Democrats are being pulled left by how much money they are given by Planned Parenthood. But let's talk about Citizens United all day long, you know, right. But yeah, well, we don't, Virginia has you know, like warmed its way into my cockles of my heart as someone who has been, you know, very disappointed in state politics. You know, I did always say Washington State, you know, for all of its crazy, crazy politics, the state legislature was always, you know, fairly solid, and the Washington State Republican Party was always fairly solid. So I'm still like, you know, hold out hope that there's like some kind of, that maybe there's some reckoning going on in Virginia. That Virginia is so close to national politics though. Is some, yeah, yeah. I mean, they're inextricable from, you know, that same with, you know, Maryland, Virginia. They're all fairly inextricable from, you know, DC politics. So you are kind of getting in there. But I am enjoying, I've realized one thing about living in the DC area. Yesterday we went to the Smithsonian American Art Museum, and I realized that,
so jealous.
I know, it's 15 minutes away from home. I was telling Jay, I was like, you know, I was like, the distance, the time and distance from our front door here to the Smithsonian American Art Museum is closer than where I lived in Washington to how far it took me to get to the grocery store in Washington State. So, but no, I realized that they have, that DC has a little bit of an attitude, about, not being a state, because their license plates, man, they go right for the jugular. It says, taxation without representation on their license plates. I'm like, damn. somebody's pissed.
Well, I'm so jealous. That sounds like so much fun to be that close.
Yeah, that's, I got wonderful. To see Barack Obama's weird coming out of the shrubs.
Oh, the shrubs official thing.
Yeah. The little crowd around that one was funny. I was like, what is this crowd for? And I turn around and look, because we were heading up in the opposite direction. I turn around and look, and I laughed out loud. I felt a little bit like self-conscious. I was like, because it was like an audible like laugh, what kind of those kind of things. So, but I didn't stop and like take it in or anything like that. But.
Was Michelle Obama's portrait there?
It is, and it was even, it shows on the map, like it says Michelle Obama's official portrait on the little map that they give you. But I didn't see it, and we apparently didn't go past it that I saw. But we saw, you know, Bill Clinton has a really weird one that in there, that's like him in kind of this like a bunch of like rain. It looks almost like a bunch of raindrops or whatever.
And it's supposed, oh, that's weird.
Yeah, it's supposedly supposed to be something about like how the Democrat, like how he's kind of out of focus because Democrats are having to like, you know, like he's there, but he's very like, you know, out of focus for them because they don't know how to handle it and stuff like, so it's like very like metaphorical. But the other thing though, dealing with one of the things that last week when I was at CNN, I was in the green room the entire time with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's spokesperson, who is about 5 years old, I think. but man, if they would have had that Green New Deal out there this week, I would have had some things to say, because this whole situation and the gaslighting about it, that they're trying to say that it didn't say things that we all saw it said as of Friday.
Yes.
And then over the weekend, they've all of a sudden on like Tucker Carlson and stuff like that, her spokespeople have all said, oh, no, but it's Republicans who are obsessing about her, Kim. It's Republicans. It's not no. Republicans are reacting to the fact that she's constantly being put in front of our faces.
Okay, so, she is a freshman lawmaker. She was tending bar about 5 minutes ago. And yes, we live in a country where you can tend bar about 5 minutes ago and then walk the halls of Congress. I mean, that's great. Fantastic women's power, America, freedom, rah, rah. That's great. But her Green New Deal is the most absurd intersection between environmentalism and progressivism I think I've ever seen. It was 14 pages long. And okay, she's a freshman senator, and this thing has been covered by CNN, NBC, MSNBC, Fox, like all these people, because she is such a digital footprint. You know, she's kind of like the celebrity,
they get good ratings,
know, yeah. Congresswoman and everything. Yeah. And this, I mean, the body of this Green New Deal, I mean, if you read about it, and I'm going to read just a few things about it. So the Green New Deal, let me X off of this. Sorry. one of the many things I should say it has in there are such things like, well, it deals a lot with identity politics, and I'm not sure exactly how identity politics will save the planet from greenhouse, you know, gas. One of the things it says, there's a resolution that relates to race and gender, and it said that this is related to climate change. It says a large racial wealth divide amounting to a difference of 20 times more wealth between the average white family and the average black family, and a gender earnings gap that results in women earning approximately 80% as much as men at the median. And then the whole issue with what the Green Deal can do is to promote justice and equity by stopping current, preventing future, and repairing historic oppression of indigenous communities, communities of color, migrant communities, deindustrialized communities, depopulated rural communities, the poor, low-income workers, the elderly, the unhoused, people with disabilities, and youth. I am not sure what that has to do at all with environmentalism and being better stewards of our planet, which we should all be better stewards of the planet. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But this creeping progressivism that's through the whole thing, it doesn't even relate to what, you know, the subject matter that she says she's talking about. Also, she proposes that there be updates or new things done to every single building in the United States. Mm-hmm. Every single building. Which I have no idea how she thinks that is going to happen. But I would say my favorite part of the whole thing is that she wants all people of the United States to, quote, receive high quality health care, affordable, safe, and adequate housing and economic security, and to provide economic security for those who are, quote, unable or unwilling to work. Now, how is that at all anything related to the environment?
And that's how part of the that part, yeah, looking, that they're trying to say.
Right. How is there. That looking at emissions and taking care of this, you know, climate change? And in David French, in his article, National Review, he talked about that he's a climate concerned individual, and it's totally okay to be climate concerned. But looking at this as the answer to all of that, she even suggests getting rid of nuclear power plants. And even people on the left have said, Alexandria, you know, if you get rid of nuclear power plants, you have to substitute that somehow with another form of energy, and that will actually increase emissions. So it kind of goes against what you're saying. So she's confused, first of all. She's trying to shove progressivism down our throats. And people are applauding her. And then, like you said, they're twisting what is going on as and putting the fault on Republicans and conservatives for saying something opposite of what she's already stated, which it's ridiculous. Ugh.
Yeah, my biggest problem with that whole thing, like you mentioned, if you don't have nuclear power as part of your environmentalist, plan, you're not a serious person about getting, you know, emissions down in the world. And if you also don't address China or India when you're doing this, you're also not a serious person who knows where most of the carbon emissions come in the world. It's not, you know, I saw this, there's this new commercial out for 4ocean.com, which is a great project, cleaning up the oceans. But, you know, the whole thing is, the commercial takes place in Bali, and it's like, well, you know where Bali is near? Bali is near these, you know, kind of still industrializing countries that don't enforce any kind of environmental controls. If the Doha, you know, resolutions had gone through, and those countries would not have restricted their emissions at all. It's all on, you know, the European Union and the Americas to deal with these new numbers. And the idea that China or India is going to reduce their emissions and has any interest in doing so when they're really concerned about propping up, you know, their communist and socialist governments, you've got a big problem when you're trying to save the world. And they don't seem to encompass, they kind of seem to extract China and India from being a part of this, you know, global climate, and saying, okay, it just involves these certain countries, which are countries that are already doing as much as they can to, mm-hmm. you know, take care of the environment. Because, and we do realize that, you know, that countries like America and like Europe and stuff like that, they were industrialized over 150 years ago. So that goes all the way back. You know, I mean, I remember having these conversations back when I was in college and talking about, you know, there's a weird theory called world systems, and it talks about the periphery and the core and just all, and it gets into, if you believe in that stuff though, it gets into social justice, because these other poor countries weren't industrialized. When the core was industrialized, they were all being, their resources were all being, you know, siphoned off to support countries in the core. So it is, and that's the part, like when we're talking about social justice and like, oh, people having affordable housing and stuff, like they've bled all of those types of, you know, I guess I don't want to say social justice so many times in a row, but they have bled on, and that's what social justice is part about, is environmentalism. And again, Kim, I know that you are on, that you are with me on the, I'm never going to forget who Van Jones is, or who he really is, and tries to make everybody forget he is. But Van Jones in the 1990s decided to go for, to change into, you know, focusing on environmentalism, because that's how he could get his communist dreams fulfilled, you know? So it's, you know, it's all wrapped up into this thing. And I always feel like I sound a little bit conspiratorialist, but I'm just like, no, these things actually exist. There's documentation of it, which I know. Trust me, my dad's a conspiracy theorist. I know that he can show you plenty of, you know, online things that show him. But I'm talking about like actual books and actual quotes of people. So,
I mean, it is all connected. And to propose this and say, you know, it's mostly about the environment, which, like you said, it has this, you know, connection to social justice and that sort of thing. It's like creeping into discussions normal people, normal voters around the country would have, where they want these certain things about, you know, the environment change, and oh, they see that it requires this and this, and then they're going to be like, okay, because at least the environment will be, you know, helped, and we can attack climate change. And yeah, it like creeps into the discussion. So Oh, another thing. Oh, I forgot to mention this. Oh, sure. She wants to construct high-speed rail and to such an extent that air travel stops becoming necessary.
Yeah, I'm never taking a train between my mom's house.
You should have taken a train from the Pacific Northwest to Virginia.
Oh my gosh. The hell that was my, which we didn't get into, the hell that was my flight here, my red eye flight here, where American Airlines lost my wheelchair for at least, it was a little over 8 hours. They lost it. You know, like the idea of that hell, and trust me, trains are not known for being wheelchair accessible, and handicap accessible. So the idea of dragging that 12-hour period, out for days, I'm sorry. Like we, yeah. I'm not ever doing that. It sounds like you don't want
to save the world, Andrea.
No, I guess not.
And I'm disappointed in you.
I know. I'm going to have to tell my daughter. Sorry, kiddo. I mean, at least the good thing is that I kind of, like, I always joke about how I only want to live to be 70. So at least, you know, I'm like restricting my own time on this earth of destroying it.
Well, did you see how Nancy Pelosi kind of like shrugged off Ocasio-Cortez's deal?
Right, because Nancy Pelosi is...
include her on like the environmental, you know, committee.
Yeah, because Nancy Pelosi, for all of her faults, is a skilled politician and an adult, and she does understand how to get things done. And I can't remember who it was I was reading, but they were talking about how the main person who got Obamacare passed was Nancy Pelosi, and bringing in the people that she knew she needed and not alienating people, which is exactly what people like AOC and Tlaib and, you know, all the other people who got Omar, Representative Omar. They are very much, you know, polarizing figures. And I know that, you know, the right has polarizing figures too. Steve King, but you know, it's like, you know, we have them too, but at the same time, like that's not how you get things done.
Yeah, I feel like they look at AOC as, I mean, she's excited, she's new, she's fresh faced, she has 2.8 million Twitter followers, Chrissy Teigen is inviting her to eat pizza and watch the Grammys at her house. Like, she's a celebrity on the left. And people, if they don't see the fact that she's like the version of Trump for them, then they're completely blinded to what celebrity does to anyone. Mm-hmm. If you like what they're saying, then you don't care how they're acting. And that goes, you know, same for Trump, same thing for AOC. It's weird.
All right. Well, Kim, I think we've like talked for almost an entire hour just between the two of us.
Oh, my goodness. That's crazy.
People are listening going like, yeah, you're two chicks. Of course you did.
Hey, we were gone for 2 months, people.
I know. I think we did fairly like, we passed over an entire month and a half's worth of politics to just talk about current stuff.
Yes. So, you're welcome, everyone.
Yes. Yes. So where can everybody reach you nowadays, Kim?
Yes, you can still find me on Twitter at Southern Keeks, K-E-E-K-S. You can find me at Washington Examiner, and you can find me at ARC Digital, which I'm very happy to be a part of.
Yeah. All right. And you can find me at Andrea N. Ruth on Twitter. And you can also, I haven't written anything for ARC Digital, but when you get, you know, if you sign up for their bi-weekly newsletter, that's me putting that together. So, you know, I am planning to write for ARC Digital at some point, and have been encouraged to do so. So I will be and plan on doing that. But you can just find me there for right now. I don't think I've got anything in the hopper anymore. I kind of like, you know, because of the move and everything, I've been setting up house instead of writing these days. So, all right. Well, find us there, and thank you for listening, and go subscribe and review, and bye.